This is Rafael Almeida. Those on Greece Pod Cafe know me as a reporter slash editor now at a newspaper in South Florida, Hispanic journalism activist extraordinaire, and all around halfway decent person except when he gets angry. And I am privileged this evening to be interviewing none other than Pawtucket. That's your cue.
Hello!
Subtle.
Yes.
Well, you are the man today, as well. We're about a week away from Greece by Thursday as taping this. And 6 years now? 6 years?
6 years, yes. Yes, it started April 21st in 2000.
Ladies and gentlemen, the story you're about to see is true. The names have been changed to protect the innocent.
Okay, you have managed to pay visits to a number of different grease spotters. You were at the famous Chicago wedding a couple of years back, Is that planned? Is that something that you want to go across the country and visit the people who've populated the boards?
I enjoy meeting people that frequent Grease Spot. It's I like meeting new people, and it's usually a lot of fun. I tend to be kind of shy, so I tend to like smaller groups than bigger groups. Bigger groups, I tend to kind of get lost, and I'm the guy that's like in the corner doing something. So, but I truly enjoy it.
I can't imagine anyone would think that the founder, creator, generator, and bottle washer of the Grease Spot Cafe is a shy person.
Well, I am. I'm fine once I know people. But at first, I tend to just be a little bit shy. I'm better at it now than I used to be, but I'm basically a shy person.
Let's take a trip back here. I'm fascinated to know the way histories of the people who've been on these boards, and I imagine that you, as like most of us, went into the way with the best of intentions and high hopes.
Yes, I got involved in the ministry, the Way International, back in 73. I had gone to school with a guy that I knew, and we actually went to a lot of concerts together. Our common bond was music, even though we had also gone to school together. And I was actually on my way to a concert called at Watkins Glen Racetrack, and I stopped to visit him, and he wasn't his normal self. He was kind of quiet, and when I stopped by, which I had done many times before, he was in the middle of this Bible thing. I couldn't really stop that night to really get into it, but I said, I'll be back and we'll talk about it, because I had always been, you know, searching for the truth, so to speak. And all of a sudden he was also, and he kind of had this breakthrough. So that was the person that got me involved with it. I started going to fellowships for, probably 6 months or so. I went to the Rock of Ages in 73. And I took the class in the end of 73. Chris Gere was actually the class instructor.
Little did you know then.
Yes, I know. And he actually caught my interest in a lot of ways, because he was one of these guys that would be good at many, many things, and he was. I remember when the class came out on video, I had to go by his house to pick up something, and he decided for the heck of it he was going to, these were these big, the when the Class first came out on video, they used these big U-matic video machines, and they weighed probably 75 pounds, and he was just taking the whole thing apart just to see how it worked. And I always like stuff like that because I'm always tinkering with gadgets and stuff. But anyway, I got involved in Rhode Island and stuck around. I took the intermediate class. I took the advanced class in the summer of 75. I got married with someone from the ministry in 75. And I stayed active and involved as a TWIG coordinator for many, many years. And I left around 86, 87. I kind of faded out. I didn't have like a day that I left. A lot of things.
It wasn't a catalyst, was it?
Well, there were a number of things. I went through a divorce. The way I saw the leadership handling my request for counseling and things like that prior to the divorce, I found it very, very disturbing. And then passing of the patriarch was a big deal. Cat just decided to jump up on my lap.
If you don't mind me asking, what was going on with the marriage? What were the kind of things that you wanted counsel on, and what was the counsel you were getting that you weren't satisfied with? I don't know if that's an appropriate question or not, but you can decide.
Yeah, no, it's we basically had kind of drifted apart. I was trying to pursue a career in writing in the television industry out in Los Angeles. She was very involved in the financial industry, and we had, other than the way ministry, we had very little in common. And the way ministry was starting to change drastically after the death of Dr. Werwell and then the passing of the patriarch, things got very, very shaken up. We all of a sudden realized that we were just two people living under the same roof. But we did at least want to get counseling and see if there was something that could be done. When I approached leadership saying that I wanted some counseling, it was like, okay, well, you know, Sunday we'll sit and talk after the branch meeting, and it's something that I've seen over the years, very typical, that they, at least from my viewpoint, they were kind of playing head games with me. You know, they said they were going to meet with me prior to the meeting, and when I asked, you know, like about 10 minutes before the meeting was starting, when we were going to meet, you know, I was told very definitely that I was, you know, should just not ask questions, and that they'd meet with me when they were ready to meet with me. And that went on even after the meeting, and I just felt, you know, this is important. This is two people's lives that are asking for help in a group that, you know, I had done a lot. I had dedicated a lot of time and energy to, and to get that kind of treatment, I quite honestly felt that it was unnecessary to address me the way they did, and it was unnecessary to treat both of us like that. You know, it was very, and then the counseling ended up coming only after I went up the ladder and contacted the limb coordinator and just bluntly told him what was going on. And suddenly that person was awfully nice to me. You know, it was one of those things that when you spend a lot of time and energy, it's not that you think that you're better or anything like that than anybody else, but that you should be, there's a certain common respect that you give to people. You know, if I had been a real jerk all the time, I wouldn't have expected to be treated anything else but a jerk. But I had been very respectful of everybody and gone out of my way in many, many times. And to be treated like that, I felt was not right.
Did you know Werewolf at all?
I met him a number of times. I always found the first time that I saw him was at the Rock of Ages in 73. I found him to be a very different person off stage than he was on stage.
How and so?
In the sense that he didn't fit, at least in my mind, what I thought was a minister, or I hate using the word man of God because it's such a
man of God with capital M and lowercase M and capital G.
Right. I think it's demeaning to the way Christ set things out. You know, I don't think the design of Christianity was to follow a man of God. And you know, my first impression of him was a almost like a, what's that term, a carny, you know, like some guy that would sell you something that you didn't need. You know, he just really came off as kind of a that he had this plan that he wanted to make money and do things. He didn't strike me as somebody that was religious. I noticed the first time I saw him, and this was one thing that I found particularly unusual, was that he seemed to gawk at women, and it struck me very, very strangely then, and that was.
And this was before knowing of any accusations of any.
Yes, yeah, this was before this, and of course that was one of those things where I never really talked about it to anybody because it was like, well, I just thought out of my own or something like that. But he definitely came off as kind of a character, not a minister of any type.
This was about when that you
this was in 1973.
Oh, so it was right away.
Yes. Yes. And of course, you know, the first class I took was audio, so when I finally took the video class, I was very surprised to see this like skinny guy compared to what he had, you know, because he was a fairly rugged individual, and obviously his weight had changed quite a bit from from the 70s to when he first filmed the class.
And okay, so you met him on those occasions. Were these one-on-one, or was this in a group setting? Or
this was group setting, yes. And
did
I
visit a twig or something?
Well, he other times that I had met him, he came to Chris Gere's house, as a matter of fact, in 74, and kind of met with, I guess it was all the twig coordinators or something like that. And it was
Were you coordinating at that time?
Yes.
Okay.
Actually, I was thinking I was an assistant coordinator at the time. And that was, you know, I enjoyed that meeting, and he seemed very, very different from what I had seen at the Rock of Ages. But he definitely had a different persona when he was on stage. When he was on, and he did it very well, I thought. But he definitely had his off and on stage personas, as far as I could see. That kind of gave me more the impression of a showman than a minister.
But it didn't raise your skepticism, certainly not enough to leave. I mean, it would be another 12-13 years if I'm hearing you correctly.
Right. I think the one thing that disturbed me quite a bit at that meeting in 74, and then there was another time that he was in the area, I think it might have been America Wakes or something like that, but I found that there were a number of girls in the area that he was overtly friendly with. You know, he was, at that time, he was, you know, a fatherly, bordering on grandfatherly type figure. In my mind, there would be certain ways of hugging and touching people that I personally found offensive. I didn't think, it struck me as some of the touching and hugging was not fatherly. It seemed more like a boyfriend and girlfriend situation. It just had a very odd tone to it, and that stuck with me, you know. And I talked about it to a couple of people, and everybody said, "Oh, you're just imagining it." But then,
did you talk to any of the women that this was?
Well, it's interesting. When my fiance at the time, she came home from a women's fellowship one night, said we decided to go out and get a bite to eat, and she wanted to talk about this teaching that had been given. And it was on, the teaching was on, I know the exact, it wasn't pleasing the man of God, but something similar to that. And she said, she goes, it was never said in the teaching, she said, but there were these insinuations that taking care of the man of God would involve up to and including sexual type things. And I said, well, what exactly did they say? And
right, you hear something like that, you want exact words,
right?
You
know? And it was all, you know, and I could tell, and because I knew the person that was doing the teaching, I said, well, you know, and I was giving her the benefit of the doubt. I said, I don't think that was the case, but I noticed that kind of like got my.
The person who did that teaching was not werewolf.
No, it was a female.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah, it was. That was what was so unusual about the teaching.
That's right. It was a woman's.
Oh, right. Okay. And from then on, I noticed different things happening. There were a lot of, and I always put them off as individual things and not a systemic problem. There were these sexual things happening between leaders and individuals, and it constantly bugged me. You know, I had a couple of girls come up to me and tell me some of the things that were asked of them by the local leadership, and it was very disturbing, very disturbing.
What's our time frame here? We're still in the 70s.
Yes. Yes, we're probably in 75 now. The leadership didn't want me to get married, and they were discouraging it. And I was living in this house, and they decided it was not a way home or anything like that. I had been in a way home, but I went off on my own, and it was a believer that had the house, and they were going to have this girl move in to another room in the house. You know, and it was like, I didn't think anything of it until the girl told me that she was specifically being sent there to seduce me so that the marriage would get canceled. And after, that was about the time that I just said, you know, I've got to take one step away from my involvement. At the time, I thought the Bible that was being taught was fine, but I was starting to see patterns in the way that these supposed ministers were on and off stage. So, anyway, that...
And yet you still stuck it out.
Well, again, it was
for
one...
A while.
For quite a while. In 79, we had been married for a few years, and we decided to move to California. And I was hoping that the problem was only happening in Rhode Island, and that it wasn't a systemic problem, because again there was, and I'm sure it's a battle that many people go through, of enjoying what's being taught versus seeing what's happening in reality. you know, for lack of a better term, we'll use the analogy of on and off stage. You know, the everything on stage was great, but when they stepped off, something else seemed to happen.
We fast forward a little bit to the 80s now, and your reaction to Martindale being named president, how did that... Did it have any effect on you? Did you know him before? Did you like him?
I had seen him. You know, he obviously did things, because I went to all the different Rock of Ages. I always found him to be very arrogant, and you know, his style of teaching was teaching the epistles as a competition. You know, as a sporting event, you know, the whole athletes of the spirit. And I found that worked to a certain extent, but it had a limited appeal, that the type of people that, according to him, were qualified were people that were athletes of the spirit. The body of Christ, so to speak, is made up of many more people than that. And I felt that the direction of the teaching and the focus of the teachings were forcing people to become certain things that they may not be. You know, it goes into a whole other thing with, you know, the Way Corps was, you know, that they wanted everybody in the Way Corps and they wanted them to all be athletes of the spirit. And I found that Martindale's teachings were very arrogant, and I felt that he was kind of the like the Zig Ziglar, you know, where you get, you know, you get these sales promotions, and you know, we've all read all the different ones, from Norman Vincent Peale to Zig Ziglar and a couple of others. I found that he came off like that, and I felt that it diminished what was really there in the Bible. You know, he was taking it and giving it a spin that ultimately would alienate a lot of people. You know, it's like I was used to rib guys at Brown University. There were a bunch of fellowships with students from Brown University, and there were a number of them that were these football jocks, and it seemed like every teaching was framed around a football analogy. You know, and I said, what if you don't like football? I said, you know, I said, could you, you know, give some variety to your teachings? That no, football's where it's at.
Did you actually discuss this with him?
not with Martindale, but with leaders, local leaders that were doing things. I said, you know, I mean, even a baseball analogy would be good, or just a life analogy. You know, it seems that, you know, analogies and parables are supposed to make clear something for people. I said, when you start talking, you know, in football terms or athletic terms, there are a lot of people that you just lose automatically.
And in this time, is this about the time frame that the marriage starts having trouble for
mm-hmm.
you?
Okay. Yes, it was in the mid-80s, 84, things started. We were starting to drift apart. And it was, you know, it was one of those departures that was amicable. We just realized that we were just two different people and had very little in common. And from the looks of it, the one thing that we did have in common was falling apart also, which was the Way International.
So wait, here's the statement I think we all heard. Any two believers, born-again believers with God's Spirit in them, can make a marriage work. It's called commitment.
Right.
And your feeling on that after?
I think we took it to the, as far as we could. The one thing that, you know, it came to a point where, you know, she felt that our marriage could work if we both went into the core. And I said if anything, that would destroy the marriage.
Why did you feel that?
Well, I felt that the whole Way Corps training was not conducive to married life. I thought that all the people that I knew that were married, that were in the Corps, had very, very difficult times during their time in the Corps with their marriage. That the marriage was the one thing that had the most stress on it.
And then you hear one night that Werwolf is no longer with us.
Yep. Yeah, I remember getting a phone call really late at night, and we had a branch coordinator that was, I think my stay in the way was elongated because he was one person that was really honest with us. And he sat down with myself and a couple of others and told us what happened at the, he told us what he thought was going to happen now that Werwolf had died. He had also had more contact with Chris Gere, and so he knew a little bit about what was coming up or what seemed to be shaping up in what ended up becoming the passing of the patriarch. And
so he knew early on some of the things Chris Gere was saying. Is that what?
He knew some of the things that he was saying, and he also knew that the tensions were building up with leadership at headquarters. When Martindale took over, I was very surprised. Almost his first official extended act was to get on stage in leotards. I found that disturbing and amusing. I got a dark sense of humor, but I felt that if he was going to be the person that was going to lead this group of people, leotards wasn't the answer. I just didn't think it was. I thought that it was very, very short-sighted of him, and I also felt that we suddenly, when Werwolf died, I forget the exact thing with Athletes of the Spirit and Dr. Werwolf's death, but I know they were relatively close, and I felt that, you know, we were on a ship with no captain. And I think for me, one of the straws that broke the camel's back was Athletes of the Spirit coloring books. I found that just, I was like going, we're teaching the kids this stuff and we don't even know if it's even right. You know, I saw the production and I just thought it was very, what's that word? Self-indulgent. You know, it became this thing that was...
They call them vanity pieces.
Yeah, yeah. It served no purpose, and I don't think that there was any glory to God in that production at all. It was, it was really odd going... I remember a few years prior to that, and maybe somebody will know the exact thing of the production, but there was a production that was put on about the word being taught in a communist country, and it was a very moving play, I thought, and really taught the importance of getting the Bible to everybody. And this one production, you know, I think it was Dr. Werwolf that walked out, and he said, well, this is the last performance of this production. And all of a sudden, he brought out the people that the story was about. It ended up that it wasn't a fictional story; it was a true story. Anyway, it was emotional. It had all the things needed for a very dramatic production. The next time I'm at headquarters, I see Athletes of the Spirit, and I just thought, oh, this place has just gone downhill. It was a ship without a captain, as far as I was concerned.
Now, did you leave, obviously, Passing of the Patriarch was read, you were not Corps, so you probably did not see it for a very long time.
I did. As I had said earlier, the branch coordinator was really good about telling us stuff, and he came back from that, I forget which Rock of Ages it was, or the Corps week in 86.
That was 86.
86, yeah. He came back and, and he called me up and another guy that was also a twig coordinator. We were both non-core, but he really trusted us. And he said, come on, let's go out for a beer. And we sat and talked for about 3 or 4 hours. And he said it's very, very possible that this thing called the Way Ministry might not be around much longer. And if it is, it won't be the thing that it had been. And he said that he was one of the first people that was pretty honest. He said, I think a lot of the people that were at Core Week were leaving and would just do their own thing.
It's okay. So you hear about this, and this was not the point that you left yet.
No. Right. I was still married, we were halfway through. We were in the process of getting divorced. And I was going through a lot with the divorce, and there was things as far as my attempting to make a career in the writing industry was not going well either. And so it was probably closer to 87 where I finally just said, this is nuts. This is just nuts. There was a new branch coordinator that came in, and the wife of the coordinator was like making passes at me. I was like going, this is just too nuts. I've got to, if nothing else, I've got to take a break from it, because there's nothing very useful happening. I'm not going to waste my time and energy to watch people start taking sides. Basically, it was becoming a political thing instead of a religious thing. It had lost all of its sparkle and charm.
Religious was a bad word in the way.
Yes, it was. But I don't think it's a bad word. I think it was one of those words that they gave a new definition to the term, I think. Is, you know, religious meant people that were stodgy and didn't really believe God and just believed in rituals. And I don't think that's true. I kind of like the word religious, and it's, you know, it is what it is. And it's, you know, religious people are not bad people. In Grease Spot, there's certain things you kind of have to avoid, and the word religious is one of them, you know, just because different people have different connotations or different definitions of the word in their head. And a lot of that's as a result of teachings and things like that.
You finally left, and it sounds, from what you said earlier, that this took place over a period of time. It wasn't a one-shot, all right, I'm out of here, good night, see you, somebody turn out the lights.
Yes, that is true. I had changed jobs, and I went through a lot of changes, and Miami Vice was out at the time. I remember that. I don't know why I remember that, because I bought one of those jackets that Don Johnson used to wear.
You realize you've just put an image in people's
head. I know. It is, yeah. I actually have a picture of it, too.
You must post.
Yeah, I don't physically have it here, but I'll get it at one of these points, and it'll be an amusing picture. I got involved with a couple of different people that had also pretty much left the ministry. In California, there was a whole other thing going on that a lot of people around the country didn't see. And basically, the Way of California kind of seceded from the Way International. They took the whole state lock, stock, and barrel. And so there was that going on, and then there were just splinter groups were happening so quickly and so fast. It was insane. Every time you turned around, somebody else had a new group, John Lynn and Ralph Dabowski, that would come around talking and kind of like trying to help people get over this whole thing. Underneath the whole thing was kind of a sales pitch for their new group. So it finally got to a point where I just said, you know, there's just something wrong right now. It needs to kind of just settle down and become something. But for me, I was just going to go out and just enjoy life. And that's what I did.
At what point did you realize, I'm really gone? This is not an active part of my life anymore.
I stopped running a fellowship at one point. It was during a Rock of Ages. I think it was 87 is what I think. There were a bunch of people that didn't go, and the branch coordinator said, can we come over, can we have a fellowship at your house? And I think it was kind of a ploy to get me back involved in things. And I said, sure. I had to, we made an event of it. We had a barbecue and a whole bit because it was during the Rock of Ages. And I made a big sign, called it the Pebble of Ages. And, you know, we had a good time and everything like this, but didn't come back or anything like that. And then time just started having its kind of distanced me from things. And I would call up the branch coordinator every once in a while and check in. And he was very empathetic about the thing. You know, with one thing that's always kind of weird is a divorce, because you've got, you know, it's almost like you have to divvy up your friends. And that was not something I wanted to do with the ministry. I had more friends than my ex-wife did. She tended to be kind of introverted, and so it was like, one of the things I know I was doing consciously was backing out and letting her have the people she needed. I knew that I could make friends and had friends that I could rely on. And then it just, I think time just became the thing that distanced me from any kind of involvement.
You had the in-between years, I guess I would have to call them, the time period between the time you left and the time you went trolling on the internet for some information about this group, I imagine, if I've mischaracterized it, but by all means, correct.
Well, actually, backtrack a little. John Udas, a Lutheran minister, he actually took the PFAL class at my house. I was the class instructor. I didn't know, I had no idea why he was taking it. Found out later when he did all of his research on the Way International. I had reached a point when I kind of backed off from everybody. I got to a very low point in my life. One of the things I kept thinking of is that way back in the 1970s, I was on this search for the truth. And now suddenly I was out of a group that had thought had the answers. And yet this group's disintegrating right around me. I didn't know what to do. One night I just decided to call John. I was over at a friend's house, and now all of a sudden things are coming out that of some of the sexual escapades that were happening and things like that. And I really hadn't left because of that. But these things are being revealed. And he had this pamphlet. John was the author of this particular pamphlet. I'm going, I know this guy. I said, he took the class. And so I jotted down the number and decided to give him a call. And he had been transferred. He had a parish still in California. And I just kind of called him and said, you know, this is all the stuff that's happening. He goes, he said, yeah, I know about all the stuff that's happening. I go, you do? And he goes, yeah. And I said, I'm confused. I'm truly confused. I don't know where to turn or anything like that. And he said, why don't you come out next Saturday and spend the day with me? Get to his house, I meet his family, and we go to his office, and he's got this file cabinet, 4-drawer file cabinet, that's filled with stuff about the Way International. I mean, just chock filled with stuff. He said, do you believe that PFAL holds the answers? You know, and I said, well, yeah. And he goes, and he went over, he was so meticulous. And I was there for probably about 10 hours. And at the time I was a smoker. And of course you couldn't smoke in his house. Right. And I took like one cigarette break the whole time. I was so engrossed. He had editions of Power for Abundant Living, like first edition up to, I think the sixth edition was out at the time. And he would take things that Werewolf had taught and go, you know, like the whole thing about adding a word, changing a word, omitting a word, and things like that. And he goes, here, read this paragraph in edition one of Power from Abundant Living. And I read it. And he goes, here it is in the second edition. I read it, and it was different. Read the third edition, different. And all the way to the sixth edition, where it was nothing like the first edition. And I was flabbergasted. I said, I've been studying this stuff for, you know, 15 years now. I said, I've never seen this stuff. And he proceeded to do that. He would take out receiving the Holy Spirit, and then he would take out, Who's the guy? Begins with an S. Stanley. Was it Stanley? The guy that was that the book was plagiarized from.
Stiles.
Stiles, thank you. Showed me just, I mean, paragraphs, just totally just copied, and showed me how he had, if you went to the first edition of Receiving the Holy Spirit, it was word for word, and it was gradually changed in each edition. And I'm going, oh, this couldn't be. And everything he had documented, he was so meticulous. I walked away just flabbergasted, and I thanked him. We stayed in touch, you know, occasionally, and I just all of a sudden realized that I had been part of something that, now whether or not the items in Receiving the Holy Spirit or Power from the Living were true, I realized that I was, and enjoying writing, plagiarism is like the mortal sin of writing, I think, you know. I mean, you can be bad at grammar and everything like that, but to plagiarize is just like the ultimate no-no. And scholastically, it is. And all of a sudden, I realized that I've been reading something that's been plagiarized. You know, Bullinger had basically done most of the Power from Unlit Living book, all the technical stuff, the key.
Or Crucifix.
Yeah. And so I walked away from that realizing that I need to just move on with my life. And I proceeded to get away from anything that had to do with the Way International for years. I made a whole new set of friends and occasionally would bump into one or two people, but for the most part stayed away for many years. And that, you know, I went through my, I think from 87 to like 92, I had a big, long, lost weekend. Nothing to do with religion or anything like that. It was just, it was very party-oriented. I'll leave most of that for another day, another story. But I had finally gotten my life to the point where I had a whole new life and didn't involve the Way International with it at all. I had a few friends that I stayed in touch with, and they also had done the same thing. They had just gotten rid of it. They, you know, some of them studied the Bible. Some of them didn't. They were moving on with their lives.
What brought you back into Way World?
Yes. I'd say right around 90 or so, I was when I first got involved with, it was probably the pre-internet, you know, with electronic bulletin boards and things like that. I was a fan of computers. In 92, I believe it was, 92 or 93, when I finally got on what I had heard about the internet. You know, I fooled around with it for a while. And once I learned how to search, I said, I wonder what's happened to the Way International. You know, is Craig Martindale still in charge? Do they even exist? And I did searches, and I had very little luck finding anything. There wasn't much information at all. And of course, search engines weren't what they are today. They were very, very crude, and you'd have to try five or six different search engines to get information. And then, I want to say, about once a year or so, I would do a search on the Way International. And I remember one year I got some results about something about Honda trying to buy the land in New Knoxville to build a plant or something. I guess it was in the late 90s, I think it was like 98, I did a search and I came across this thing called Transnet, which was, there are a couple of people that post at GreeSpot. I'm sure they could start a thread and kind of give the ins and outs of Transnet, but it was quite an amazing little, I don't know, it was a cross between a chat room and a forum. And people would post, and it was just, I read it, and it was so chaotic, you know, because there were just, people would change subjects, and, you know, it wasn't like a forum where you can have one topic, and, or, you know, 100 topics, and you can read just the ones you want. This was kind of just a mishmash of things. So I read it a little bit, and it didn't really interest me all that much. So I kind of said, okay, well, you know, next year I'll do another search and see what I find. And so it was, I guess in 99, did a search, and I came across this place called Waydale. It was much different than Transnet. It was very kind of orderly. And there was a forum, and people were discussing things. And so I started reading it, and I would go back, and maybe once a week I'd go in and read things. And then it started expanding, and more people were coming in, and there were people like Orange Cat, and there was a guy named Carl, and there was at one point there was a guy named Pseudo. I would read along with these things and never considered posting or anything like that because I really didn't have anything to say. But the more I read, the more I was like going, well, maybe I do have something to say. But then I said, nah, I'll just read. They opened a section in the forum called Friend Finder. And there were a couple of people that I was going, gee, whatever happened to this person or that person? So there was this one girl that she was a real sweetheart. I had known her in Rhode Island. I had lost track of her. And I had, one thing with the internet is that you could sort of track old friends and that. And I enjoyed that. I decided that I was going to post on Waydale. So I had to pick a name. And the only reason I was going to post was to post in this friend tracker thing and see if I could get in touch with this friend Pam that I knew. And I was going, I said, well, I want to pick a name that, you know, if she sees that name, she'll know it's me. Mm-hmm. And so I was one of the only people that came from Pawtucket. And I said, that's what I'll call myself. I'll call myself Pawtucket so that she will recognize my name or who I am without giving away my name. And sure enough, within about a week, a friend of a friend of a friend got in contact with her and said, you should go to this Waydale board. There's some guy named Pawtucket that's looking for you. And we actually got in touch. I ended up going to visit her and the guy that had witnessed to me were both living in North Carolina. And so I made a trip of it, went out and visited and had a good time. But after that, I started posting. I'd get involved and I found it, my first impression when I started posting was, you know, I'd post and then nobody would respond to the post, you know, and I think, you know, and I was going, well, the hell with them. I'm not going to post anymore. And of course, as has become the tradition at Waydale and at Greasepot is the need to announce that you're not going to post anymore.
Oh, of course. Yeah.
So I resigned a couple of times there. And finally, it was either Orange Cat or Pseudo that said, you know, don't take it personally. It's just, you know, people go off on tangents and things like that. Then I started making friends, and then they opened up a chat room. And then I'd go in the chat room, and that was a lot of fun, you know. And it was not anything to do with the Way International, but it was just fun just chatting. Because it was also chat, the whole concept of a chat room was fairly new at that time. It was, it hadn't been around on the internet all that much. And so I, being a tech guy, I loved just the technology of it. But I found that I was being dragged in. You know, I was getting more and more involved in this thing.
Just when they thought I was out, they pull me back in. All right, Kay, just this one time.
The next thing was, somebody had the bright idea to do a billboard in New Knoxville. And I was like going, that's a great project. I think that's worth doing. So I got involved in that. And the person that was doing the design was upset with the person coordinating and finally just said, I can't do this anymore, you know. And so I took she gave me the artwork and then I redesigned it and made what became the first billboard project that went up. And it was interesting to do it. You know, we had our arguments and disagreements, but ultimately we did get this this billboard up. I think it said, your doubts are real and reasonable. And down at the bottom it was, you know, people or something like that. And then it gave a web address. And of course, we put that at the bottom of the billboard, and that got graffitied within 24 hours of the billboard going up.
By good Christian people.
Yes.
And that story is, of course, grease spot legend, because it's really something that got a lot of people's attention.
Right.
And Waydale legend, for that matter. At what point do you say we need to do something other than Waydale? We need to branch, for lack of a better word.
When Grease Spot started, I think earlier I said the lawsuits were out. I don't think the lawsuits were out at the time. At least when I first conceived it, I talked with this friend of mine when I made the trip to North Carolina. The guy that I was friends with that had witnessed to me was a counselor. We spent 2 days together and talked at length about the condition of people that had left the Way International. How people were just left hanging. Not so much in the later years, or people that leave recently didn't have quite the same effect, but people early on, the Way International was their whole life. It was all-encompassing. It was all their friends were people in the Way International. Everything that they did in life that was meaningful had to do with the Way International. And all of a sudden, when people left or got cut out of the core or something like that, they were left with nothing. It was devastating for a lot of people. And a lot of people were very hurt and confused. And there weren't, other than Waydale, there weren't many places on the internet to get information to find out, basically, am I nuts? Am I crazy? Is what I'm thinking right or wrong? All different things that were valid emotions and questions that people that left the Way had. But there was no way to get the questions answered or get a fulfilling, meaningful answer that would say, oh, okay, I'm not crazy, I'm not nuts. We spent a lot of time talking about that, and it really got me thinking. And I thought, you know, Waydale is roots in kind of discussing, there was a lot of doctrinal type discussions. There weren't as many, you know, I'm feeling this way. Feelings, nothing more than feelings. That wasn't being discussed as much. And there were a lot of people that were hurt. And there were a lot of people that had left many years prior that were still, they had to put that part of their life on a shelf. And they never had the time to kind of rationalize it or I guess for lack of a better term, mourn the death of that part of their life, to be able to put some resolution to it, to have some closure. So I said, you know, it would be nice if there was a site where that could happen. And that was kind of the genesis of what ended up becoming Grease Spot. In fact, the first article, and I maybe for the anniversary I'll see if I can dig it out. The first article that was submitted was by Groucho Marx Jr. about the loss of a child in his marriage, and it was very, very touching. But I tried to get more people involved, and it was difficult because Waydale was like the hip happening place, you know.
Right.
You know, I've opened up a little place down the street, and you know, it's like, well, why go to your place? We can go to Waydale. They serve everything we need. So I decided, well, I'm going to keep it going and just see what develops. And my friend in North Carolina, we had discussed the possibility of seeing if we could get some counselors to donate time and have the forums be more of an interactive thing with a counselor, where we could, something similar to that book, the abuse of, what's that book?
I'm trying to remember the name of it myself.
I always screw up the name. The Subtle Abuse of Spiritual Power, something like that. There was a female minister that had done an article about the abuse that was done by ministers using their power to get sexual favors. And so,
the subtle power of spiritual abuse.
Thank you. The subtle power of spiritual abuse. And I thought, why not have something that could revolve around things like that so that people could start getting some answers and getting some resolution in their life? So I plugged away at that. So I finally opened Grease Spot. And of course, that night, there was this guy from Florida that started a thread.
Oh yeah, there was that.
Yes.
Same night. Nobody knows that Grease Spot and the thread are twins.
And I had posted a thread saying, you know, Grease Spot's open, come over and visit, blah 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 blah. And everybody's in this thread about the, and it took on that's a whole other discussion. The amazing. The following this whole thing about thee, it just became this phenomenon at Waydale. And
I have wanted to beat that thread to death for years.
And I remember going in the chat room, and I said, well, we got Grease Spot open and running. And everybody, did you see that thread that Raphael started? And I'm going, what thread? And I go and see it, and I'm going, all it says is thee, and then I think, well, wasn't it? Or, well. Yeah. And I'm going, what the hell kind of a thread is that? So I still do to a certain extent, but back then I tended to get my feelings hurt very easily. And so I'd be in there and go, yeah, I'm really excited about Grease Spot opening up. Did you hear about this thread that Raphael's got going? And it was, and that was like the whole talk of chat the whole evening, you know. And I finally it was just like, I said, all right, I said, I'm going to post on this thread too. And I was like the, I don't know, the eighth or tenth poster on the thing, and just had fun with it, because when it started out, it was just really a very fun thread. It would be lovely to analyze that thing sometime, but there were days. There were more posts on the thread than there were in the whole Grease Spot forum. And so I just kind of resigned myself to it and sit still and just enjoyed having it. And then it gave me time to kind of develop it a little bit more and put more into it. Somewhere along that time, shortly after I opened it, the lawsuit got announced that the Allens were doing against The Way International, specifically against Craig Martindale. As that was unfolding, I saw Grease Spot having a spot, having a place, but that it was gonna have a place that might not happen for another 5 or 6 months, or a year maybe, you know, because I had no idea how long it would be before this thing would go to trial. And from all indications, it was going to go to trial. I mean, we even had Pam San Diego was actually going to be at the trial. We were going to have a reporter and everything like this. And I was going, we can finally scoop Waydale. We'll have somebody actually there, you know. And I'm thinking, well, the Allens will be there too. They can really give firsthand reports. So it was a quiet, low-key beginning. But I did see that there was going to come a point where it would become, I don't know how much importance it would have, but I knew that it would be a vital and real source of information in one form or another.
I hope you enjoyed this special episode of Grease Spot Radio. My special thanks to Roth for stepping up to the plate. And this is only part one of episode number 3. Part 2 should be up shortly.